This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur originated as the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio. The weather and climate news felt too urgent to abandon when Extinction Radio went on hiatus last spring, so Sequitur became a freestanding podcast. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded beyond extreme weather events and natural disasters to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book The Myth of Human Supremacy to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's your old pal Benjamin the Donkey, back again with more Limericks of Doom.
Welcome back, Benji. Did you have a refreshing vacation?
Hee-haw!
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 Well, good. I'm glad you're back in time for the Fukushima shows, because I know you have a lot to contribute on that issue.
You know, it's not all bad news. There's always a silver lining. When the grid goes down, everyone freaks. Nuke plants blow, radiation leaks. But you won't need much cash to build up your stash when you're dead in a matter of weeks. Anyway, my plans are pretty much in place for emergency evacuation. I've already planned in advance what to do in a doom circumstance. My very first chore, make the toilet before I evacuate into my pants. Hee-haw!
Good idea, Benji. But I was hoping you would have something of a more supportive nature to offer our listeners.
You know, Japan is supposed to host the 2020 Olympic Games, but with Fukushima out of control until, well, as far as humans are concerned, forever, I don't know. It's too much risk to proclaim that Japan hosts the Olympic flame. This ain't no joke, yo. If there's no more Tokyo, there'll be no Olympic Games. Fukushima sits on the ocean, where earthquakes often cause motion. What will I do if the worst comes true? I haven't the foggiest notion. If Japan went all fucko bazoo, and your days left were only a few, say it happened right now, how would you say ciao? What do you think you would do? Hee-haw!
Oh, Benji, you're just as clueless as anyone else. You know, I had originally intended for today's show to be an update on the Fukushima radiation plume. Have you heard that the radiation signature of that triple disaster has been detected off the coast of Oregon? Have you heard that the massive die-offs of marine life are being attributed to radiation poisoning? Do you have friends who won't eat seafood sourced from the Pacific Ocean, or at least not in the Northern Hemisphere? I do. But I don't see the point, since the oceans are all connected, despite our compartmentalizing them with separate names on our maps. And oceanic currents for a mixing effect and migratory beings who tend to be further up on the food chain add a concentrating effect to the contamination.
You know, radiation's coming inbound till there's nowhere it cannot be found. It's sure to get there via water or air. That Fuku shit sure gets around. Actually, they're picking up radiation from Japan right here in the U.S. But experts like the United Nations say not to worry. Radiation helps make you strong. It won't hurt or do anything wrong. UN health groups agree that there's nothing to see. That is all. Now please move along. UN health experts agree, and they're giving it their guarantee. Based on separate sources, the UN endorses it's good for both you and for me. When problems tend to go global, state scientists may go ignoble. Epidemiology downplays pathology, pretty much like at Chernobyl. Yeehaw!
This collusion and cover-up stuff reminds me of the bind we're in with climate chaos. On the one hand, some clarity and honesty would be nice. But on the other hand, considering the crazy-making nature of the predicament, I have to admit that there might be such a thing as too much information. Did I say Fukushima shows, plural? Yes, I did. I can't do the intended update on the radiation plume because of the media blackout. Even if the Japanese media were not so heavily censored, the Western media doesn't want a panic on its hands, and a scientific investigation would contribute only to such a panic and not at all to anyone's paycheck or corporate bottom line. So reliable, objective, current information is very hard to come by. It's like, what are we supposed to do? Just make the shit up?
The Ballad of Spent Fuel Pool 4. In old Fukushima, Japan, the shit finally hit the fan. A spent fuel pool, which they tried to keep cool, was sketchy, is how it began. No one was worried at all that the rods had no ceiling or wall. The danger was greater that sooner or later the whole thing was going to fall. At last, folks couldn't ignore what had been lying in store. Then a quake came along sufficiently strong to topple SFP-4. Collapse and worldwide privation resulted in upkeep cessation. Rods elsewhere suspended, also untended, let loose lots more radiation. Sixth extinctions not fully explained by the multiple rads that reigned. As at Chernobyl, warming gone global finished off most of what life remained. Yeehaw!
Yeah, I guess we're just making this shit up. So, next week, I'll do a follow-up show to feature the findings of the Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Commission, published in July 2012, and covering the disaster itself. Kiyoshi Kurokawa, chairman of that commission, was one of three panelists who spoke at Cornell University on the 5th anniversary of the disaster last March, and I'll report on that as well. Next week. This week, I bring you instead an interview with a very special guest who will give us a first-hand, personal account of her experience of the disaster and her ongoing contribution to recovery and accommodation to the consequences of our hubris and greed. But let's start with a brief acknowledgement for the equinox, the moment at which the light and the dark are equally balanced. In the Northern Hemisphere, as of a few hours ago, the balance has tipped toward the light. It's the vernal equinox, sacred to dawn, youth, the morning star, and the east. A time of new life in both plant and animal kingdoms. A time of germinating seeds and hatching birds, which is why traditional foods typically include whole grains and eggs. In its most extreme form, it is a celebration of rebirth or resurrection. It is the ancient Persian New Year and also the beginning of the astrological year. The ancient Roman New Year has already passed. It was on the Ides of March. Between the 12th century and 1752 in England and Ireland, the New Year is yet to come on March 25th. As you can probably see, that everyone should use the same calendar is a relatively recent notion. Okay, all of that being said, let's hear our featured interview with Yumi Kikuchi, practitioner with her husband Gen Morita of ancient Japanese medicine and co-founder of Rasur Japan and Fukushima Kids Hawaii, and also together with Gen, an accomplished musician. I'm sharing a live recording from our Speak for Peace concert event of 7 years ago for the very fact that it predates the Fukushima disaster. So here's yours truly introducing Yumi, and Yumi playing Greensleeves on her flute, accompanied by Gen on the guitar. After Greensleeves, we'll have a short poetry reading by Deba Cale Earnshaw before we take a deep dive into the life of my friend and colleague, Yumi Kikuchi, a courageous and powerful Fukushima refugee and activist.
Hi.
Hi, Gen. It's good to hear your voice. I'm about to play a clip from our concert at the Red Victorian Peace Center in Bed and Breakfast in 2010.
San Francisco.
I had to tweak the EQ to make the speaking and the flute reasonably clear, so I hope you'll forgive me for destroying the fine tone quality of your instrument and the articulation style of your playing.
Yeah.
It's really a privilege for me to be able to present Yumi to you. Yumi is one of the charter members of the Global Alliance for Ministries and Departments of Peace. She has been instrumental in creating a campaign to have a Ministry of Peace in Japan. She has also worked on the campaign in Costa Rica, which was successful just last year. She has also worked hard on the campaign here in the United States. So I'm really pleased that somebody like this is one of my fellow participants in BAYNVC's leadership program.
What Gen and I have been doing in this country is we are giving free concert to promote peace. What we are doing is the music of the world, folk songs. So we play each one song from each country. This is from Scotland.
It's Deba Cale Earnshaw here with this week's poem. It's by Millen Brand, and it's called August 6th, 1945. Fred Brown has just leaned out on a low windowsill that needs painting. There are cracks in it, but so far they have let no rain through. They can wait a little longer. This moment is his to enjoy. Looking at his apple orchard and two small plum trees, and under them a red napkin of bee balm. It is beautiful and peaceful. His wife is troweling a flower bed along the house wall. He hears the thud of an apple falling, part of the nice lethargy of the day. And today, across the world, behind a plane, the Enola Gay. There floats in the air, slowly descending, a hardly visible thin tube, the small fuse at one end, that will fire one of two parts at the other end and explode this almost unnoticeable filament, with a light brighter than the sun. Below, in the wooden city of Hiroshima, can it not be that a man has just rolled back one of his living room shutters and is looking out on his garden, thinking, the morning glories on their bamboo sticks, the blue sky, how beautiful everything is. Let me enjoy it. I should be painting shutters, but they can wait. The rain does not come through yet.
So Dan is working in Hiroshima and I'm here in Kona and being interviewed by Susan.
I'll have to speak with Gen another time about his work in Hiroshima, the site of a nuclear disaster that made no pretense of being due to natural causes. Imagine if the Japanese people had become as xenophobic about Westerners in the wake of that apocalyptic event as so-called Americans have become about Islam in the wake of the fall of the World Trade Center. But that's another topic for another interview. So I want to jump right into the Fukushima tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I wanted you to do, Yumi, is talk to the listeners a little bit about where you were and what you were doing when it happened.
Okay. So let me see. On March 11, 2011, I was in downtown Tokyo in this building, kind of old building that was in preparation for the film festival. And this, the biggest earthquake I ever experienced happened. And at the beginning, it was, you know, started a little bit weak and then gets stronger, stronger, and lasted for a long time. I thought this is bad. This is going to be really a big one. And I had no idea where the epicenter was. Because the building was very old, somebody told us get out of the building because it could collapse. So I went down to the street, then I looked up and it's such a narrow street and high skyscrapers. And I was in this narrow street looking up and building was shaking. I thought I was going to die. And in that moment when I thought I was going to die here, I thought of my kids first, my children. Oh, it's too bad they don't find me. I realized how much I care for my children. And then I decided to go back into the building because I thought it's better to be in the building than outside on the street. If the windows start falling, I'd be dead in this sharp glasses stuck on me. So I went inside actually. And none of those happened. I was intact. Building was okay. And Tokyo wasn't hit so much compared to Tohoku. The epicenter soon I found was in Miyagi Prefecture, near Sendai. And I said, oh my God, Sendai has Onagawa nuclear power plant. I thought of the nuclear power plant near the epicenter, which didn't go meltdown.
Mm.
That was the first thing I thought after thinking of my family. And then somebody in the street told me, somebody I met there, his phone was still connected to the internet. Mine wasn't. Mine was dead. But his was saying epicenter was Sendai, near Miyagi. And the two nuclear power plants near the epicenter were good, intact. So I was very, very relieved. And I stayed inside the building. And everything shut down, like electric power. The phone, cell phones were dead. And I couldn't communicate with my family. And all the trains stopped. And I was 3 hours away from my family. I was in Tokyo that day working. And my family lived in Kamogawa, Chiba, which is like 3 hours away. And I had no idea if they are safe or they are alive. I had no idea. And that night, about 100 of us who were in that building that day, that moment, stayed in the building. And spent a night in a shake because one after another aftershake was happening that night. So we were shaking all night.
Aftershock, yes.
Yeah. And about 10 o'clock, one of the TV was on and I was watching the TV news. That was, I think, NHK was on. And it reported at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, they lost
all the powers. It's called a station blackout. That was a very short news, and it wasn't reported by the announcers, but it was a, how to say it?
Do you the know? Subscript the, there.
Yes. It was says station blackout at Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant.
But the announcer didn't say anything?
No, they were reporting something else. But at the moment I saw that line, my heart quenched. Because I know what it meant. Wow, in 1 to 2 hours later, unless we have the power, it will start melting. It will start melting.
Right. And what did you think about how could it be that the power plants that were closer to the epicenter were safe, but Fukushima had a power failure? What did you think at the time how that could happen?
I thought Fukushima had a very old reactor, that especially the number one. We always had a problem with that reactor from the beginning. That has had a failure from the beginning. They made the inside of, what do you call it, the vessel, you know, different from original, what do you call it, the measurement, they made something wrong. It's made by General Electric, and they made it wrong from the beginning. So that was my knowledge. So I thought maybe because of Fukushima Daiichi is much older, older means more susceptible to accidents, and Onagawa is newer, but maybe they were just lucky or they were safer than Fukushima. I thought Fukushima is older ones and they are more susceptible to accident. That was my thought.
So it was older and it was not necessarily in conformity with the design specifications, is what I'm hearing you say.
Unit 1 was built wrong.
Uh-huh.
And we knew about it. Yeah, I was part of the filing lawsuits closing down the Unit 1 because it had some failure from the beginning. Some measurement, it was different from the blueprint.
So you were on Fukushima before the earthquake ever happened.
I was on the lawsuit. I was on that issue because Fukushima was one of the older and more dangerous power plant in Japan. We have, by the way, 54 nuclear reactors. And I thought Fukushima 1, especially the Daiichi and Unit 1, need to be shut down right away because of that reason. So it was something I was aware before the March 11.
I don't think the rest of the world knows.
Mr. Kikuchi, who was one of the person who were working for General Electric at that time, and he was a whistleblower. He was bringing that knowledge after he quit the General Electric to inform us the danger of the nuclear power plant. Mr. Kikuchi, who's now a photographer in the south of Japan, he informed all of us that danger, a possible danger of Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plants, Unit 1.
And he has the same last name as you do.
Yeah, it was a coincidence. We are not related.
Okay.
He is a GE engineer.
Okay.
So he had inside knowledge.
So he had knowledge that the plant as built was different from the way it was specified on the blueprint. Is that it?
Yes.
Wow.
It's supposed to be the perfect round.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I know, it's a little bit crooked. It's not the perfect round.
Huh.
They had to adjust it somehow.
The containment pool for the cooling pool.
Yes. The most important insight. So that was what I heard from Mr. Kikuchi many years ago, maybe 20, 30, 20 years ago.
Wow.
And Fukushima Daiichi was one of the oldest plants. And it had to be shut down before. You can ask another question.
Okay, yeah. So here you are in Tokyo and you found out that Fukushima had had a meltdown.
They never say that. Susan, that's a very important point. They only said station blackout.
Electrical failure. You're the one that knew that it was going to be a meltdown because you know what's happening.
Nobody knew. Station blackout means possible meltdown. Nobody knew. It's not public knowledge.
Right.
It's not common knowledge to people. They said station blackout, as far as I know, maybe once or twice. And then nobody said anything about it. After that, there was no news about Fukushima Daiichi.
No news. Mm-hmm. Media blackout.
Media blackout. And it was funny. They told us 2 months later, it's melting down.
2 months.
The world knew already. Everybody, my nuclear activist friends, the scientists from other than Japan, they all knew it's already melted down. So I knew. But it was not in the news in Japan for about 2 months.
Wow.
Until May.
Okay, let's back up to March, though, and tell me about how here you are in Tokyo, worried about your family, and tell me how you got reunited with your family and about the move to Hawaii.
So I spent the night there with about 100 other people who couldn't go home. And there are so many, actually, maybe a million people or more who were stuck in Tokyo that night because there was no means to go home. So I was so far away, I couldn't walk. So I stayed in that building. And woke up, I didn't sleep, but I started get out of the building and started walk to the station at Ikebukuro, and there's no train running. But eventually I found a subway. I had to catch the news that subway is working. So I went walk to the subway station and found a way closer to my family where they're in Chiba. So I found there is another line called the Keisei line that started moving. Usually it takes me to Chiba City about 40 minutes by train usually, but it took me 6 hours that day.
Wow.
You know, taking many ways, many different lines to finally get to Chiba. And my Twitter was alive. I was connected to internet and the Twitter was alive. And I was able to send my family or everybody who's reading my Twitter that I'm alive and I'm safe. I'm going to Chiba. And I hope you can come to pick me up there.
Uh-huh.
And that news, and we were able to connect that day about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So they drove about an hour and a half to catch me in Chiba.
Uh-huh.
So they, after we united, you know, my little one was 9 and 10 years old at that time. And both Gen and I looked at the first thing we communicated was, nuclear power plants is already melted down, I said. And again said the same thing.
Oh, my goodness.
We both knew that that was the first thing after we hugged and we, you know, we reunited and we were so happy to find each other. The next conversation was, it's already melted down. We are out of here. Both of us.
What is it that you had to leave behind in order to get out of there?
We had an organic farm. We were living a very self-sufficient living. You know, I'm a peace advocate, but to create peace, you need to grow your own food close to the earth and do not create garbage. Try to live a life according to the law of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that we were trying to practice. And we were growing rice and vegetables and mushrooms and fruits, whatever we could grow. We are from Tokyo, so we both had no idea about farming, but we did that anyway for about 12 to 13 years in Kamogawa, which is in Chiba Prefecture. Fukushima is 2 prefectures away. Next to Fukushima to the south is Ibaraki. So Fukushima, Ibaraki, Chiba. And my town is maybe about 150 miles from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant.
And how far from Tokyo?
Tokyo is also close to Fukushima. It's maybe about 200 miles from Fukushima.
Uh-huh.
You're listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace. Personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
Anyway, when the Chernobyl happened, depending on where the wind is blowing and how strong the wind, the radiation spread very rapidly. So we didn't have much time, you know, to think or to prepare. We didn't have passport or anything. So we had to go home to Chiba from Kamogawa. And I was telling my kids, in 2 hours, we're going to be out of here and we may not come back. Maybe I didn't say we may not come back, but we are not coming back for a while. But I said, we are leaving in 2 hours. I gave each one just one knapsack and you can fill whatever you need, whatever is dear to you. You put everything in here and we are out of here. In 2 hours. That's what I told them. So we were planning to go as far as possible that day. And we wanted to go to Okinawa, but all the flights were fully booked. Furthest we could go then was Fukuoka. So after 2 hours, after we packed the minimal things, we got passports and I had very few things. We left everything, the organic farm, our love and sweat and all the joy behind. 200 years old home, we renovated so beautifully. We loved the house, we loved the way we lived. But nothing was more important than the health of our children. We needed to make them away from radiation way before the plume is coming to our way. I called my friends in the community of Kamogawa because I had quite a few important people in my life that also lived a very self-sufficient and caring living close to Earth. Some had babies, some had children that is smaller than mine. The younger, the more susceptible to radiation. So I wanted them to prepare for what may be coming because the radiation is coming, maybe coming, and I believe it's already melted down. And I left the booklet, What to Do When the Radiation Comes, What You Could Do at Home to Protect Your Children. I had many books and information. So I left that for my community. That was all I could do for my community, and we left. It didn't hit our town. It went around our town, actually. So we were not badly hit by radiation, by the way. We found out that later. But at that time, because it's only 150 miles away, I was preparing for the worst. First, we went to Fukushima, and then we went to Okinawa. Okinawa is one of my, like, home, where we had many fellow peace activists who were, like, trying to stop the U.S. bases there. So I had many, many friends there. Before I went to Okinawa, I called my fellow activists. I'm coming to you because I think Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant is already melted, and radiation is going to spread. I need to get out of here. So I found a place to stay. And then I called all my friends in Okinawa. I told them, we need to evacuate babies and pregnant women as soon and as many as possible. And they had no idea what I was talking about because in the news say everything is okay, under control, and nuclear power plant is safe. They're not telling it's melted down. But I'm not a nuclear scientist, but I was telling them it's already melted down. But some people believed me, some people suspicious, but I gathered enough people in Okinawa who helped us to create a center. It's called a Tsunagu Hikari, Connecting Light. We were one of the first people who started getting babies and pregnant women out of the place. Nobody's talking about radiation at that time. Anyway, in Okinawa, in the third day after the earthquake, we did a big press conference at the prefecture center. And we announced our plan, and it was on the newspaper of Okinawa. They were more open or more liberal to talk about those things, so I was able to put this news in the newspaper in Okinawa.
So, but, Yumi, from what I've been able to see in the independent investigation report, it said that in the first 3 days, there were a couple or three major explosions.
Yes, yes.
How can you keep that a secret?
Explosion is just from the hydrogen and say it's not melted. They could take us very easily because there's not many people at that time in Japan knew about nuclear power plants unless you are against it or unless you are working for the industry. I was against it, so I studied enough, but it wasn't common knowledge. It's exploded, but they can still say it's still okay. The meltdown, the word meltdown didn't come for 2 months. Nobody said that in the news.
So they can say power failure and they can say explosion, but as long as they don't say meltdown, people think it's okay.
A lot of Japanese people were, in a way, I don't want to use a word, but deceived because there was no news, especially the people in Fukushima were living there, exposing their families to radiation for a long time. And even after, even now, they say the radiation is safe to a certain extent. You know, they call it safe. They change the standard of safety standards. Mm-hmm. So loose. I remember it used to be 1 millisievert per year exposure for general public like me. But now I can be exposed to 20 millisievert per year and it's still considered to be safe and legal. It wasn't legal before March 11.
Hee-haw! If raised limits are making you cuckoo to the point you consider seppuku, think how much will explode and still be up to code when the grid's down and everything's fuku. Hee-haw!
So they changed the law so that people can live there, which maybe, I don't know, to some people, it's maybe they're happy to be able to live there legally. But to me, as a mother, as you know me, I took my kids out of the place as soon without much thinking, because I told you the health of my children is most important, more than my life. And I guess that's the same for many people, or many moms in Japan, I hope.
If you happen to live near a nuclear plant, you've probably already made plans for evacuation. Despite some large movement rants for escaping nuclear plants, there's no place to go. Evacuation, though, might take place right in our pants. Hee-haw!
But some people will be sick by leaving home because they miss their community so much. They miss their way of living. Fukushima is, by the way, a very beautiful rural place, very beautiful nature, abundant. And they are close to land. They are close to ocean. There are many fishermen and many farmers. Mm-hmm. They're not sick people. So leaving home, leaving their farmland, leaving their ocean, it must be not only heartbreaking, but like cutting off your soul. So yeah. I could understand people can't just leave. Yeah, after all, I'm from Tokyo, and I lived in Kamogawa for 15 years, and I love the place. But I could easily move. I was able to. But for many Fukushima people, their homes is their soul, their ancestors. They're like native people.
Yeah.
As you can. Yeah. So it's very more complicated.
I totally get that. You know, I come from New Orleans, and we see that with the hurricane evacuations all the time, too, that they would rather die in place than live homeless.
Yes, yeah.
And I get that. I totally get that.
So I was creating a movement in Okinawa to evacuate pregnant women and babies. That was the first thing we did.
Yeah.
And thanks to one of the best friends from Okinawa, they immediately after I talked about this is a meltdown, it's emergency, they quit their job and I take this from me. I take this. I'm in charge. Can you believe that? Two people committed right away. They will help evacuate moms and babies, the pregnant women and the babies are the most vulnerable population to radiation.
And get them out of Fukushima.
They created a housing project.
In Okinawa.
In Okinawa, yeah. From Fukushima, Okinawa. That was huge relief for me because I knew that something I had to do before I go to Hawaii. And they took my torch. They took my torch and they carried it because I couldn't be in Japan because I was leaving for Hawaii in 10 days.
What brought that decision on?
We were planning to go to Hawaii anyway. We had a plane ticket leaving for Hawaii on the 20th, March 20th.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was a family vacation trip during the spring break. But we only took one way and never came back. It was supposed to be just a 2 weeks vacation in Hawaii. And we always wanted to live in Hawaii. But it was difficult to leave the country because we had so many different projects going on in Japan and we had so many commitments. And that day, March 11, I really realized nothing is more important than the life of children. Nothing is more important. That's the most important. And to protect that, I do anything. So I left all my projects. I left all whatever commitment, prior commitments I made. I said, I'm sorry. I'm leaving Japan and I'm going to live in Hawaii. And that's what I did.
You're a very courageous woman.
Courageous? Some people say that, but that means I had to say no to so many people. So I have some regrets and pain around it.
I'm just so interested in the timing that you already had that plane ticket.
Yeah.
And that's when the earthquake came and sort of made your decision for you, didn't it?
It did, it did. Gen and I still went back to Japan after the vacation, but we left our Mana and Anna to different homes. You know, we find a foster home for the time we are in Japan. We couldn't keep them together, so they have to go different ways. A girl was taken by Mayumi Oda, who is the artist. And the boy is taken by a Hawaiian person that we trusted at that time. So they went to two different families until we come back from Japan.
Uh-huh. You went back to Japan in order to...
Recollect things, yeah, because we didn't bring anything.
In order to wrap up your affairs, put your affairs in order and...
Right. I had a few prior commitments I made I wanted to keep, so I went home and I did some of the things. So Gen went back maybe in 1 month or so, and I went back after 2 months or so.
Back to Hawaii.
Yeah. Back to Hawaii, and then we were searching home because we were living in a tiny condominium, one studio, smaller than, I don't know, 30 square feet or less, maybe 20 square feet.
Oh my goodness.
Four of us living in one studio.
Oh my goodness, all four of you.
Yeah, all of us. We are tiny people, as you know. We could fit. We can happily live there, but we needed a kitchen. So we were searching home.
Bringing the leadership program back into it, I want to back up again. Here we are in 2011. If I remember correctly, Gen was in the leadership program in 2011, and you were on the leadership support team. So how did that all fit in with your evacuation plans?
Well, because we're already in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. The important thing we were able to leave is just 1 month before the earthquake, March 11th, actually almost 2 months. On January 21st, my mother passed.
Oh.
So that was a time my mother was getting very ill. And the day I was on the flight to leadership program on the January 20th, that's for 20 or 21, I had a call in the flight just as I board. I had my cell phone rang from the hospital that I had to leave the airplane, went to the hospital, and saw her die.
Oh, my goodness.
I left Gen there. So Gen, you go. And Gen went through the leadership program. I stayed, of course, with my mom, and we did the funeral, and we did all the things needed to done very quickly. And I went back to the maybe last 2 or 3 days of the leadership program.
That was the first retreat.
Yeah, first retreat, yeah, in January. And then we went back to Japan, and March 11 happened. If my mother were alive, it wasn't easy for me to leave Japan. That made it easier to leave Japan.
Yeah, I guess so.
If I had my sick mother behind, I would be always thinking about my mom. So I was, of course, sad losing her. You know, as the leadership program, they gave me a lot of empathy. That was such a gift. I was able to cry. I was able to mourn. So I think I was back on my feet very quickly because of leadership program. And March 11 happened, and we went to Okinawa, and we had two people. They created an amazing project, actually, in Okinawa that lasted 2 years. They left their job and did that as a volunteer. You know, it's amazing. They had so much commitment. And they managed, and they got 264 moms and babies and pregnant women from Fukushima to Okinawa.
Wow.
That's something they did. I mean, I did first organizing only.
With no help from the government and no help from TEPCO.
No, nothing. It's all people's goodwill. People's kindness and compassion only. And somebody who trusted people like me. I'm not scientist, but they all trusted what I said. It's already melted down. You need to prepare homes.
As far as evaluating the magnitude of your impact, if you had unlimited resources, how many pregnant women and children, young families would have been evacuated?
I wanted to sponsor everyone to evacuate, at least the beginning of the nuclear accident, when they're releasing so much radiation. The first few days is most critical, as you know. They need to be away. Then they may be able to come back. I wish I could give all the children homes. There are 300,000 kids living in Fukushima.
300,000
children living in Fukushima at that time.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and I could only touch a few. One drop in the ocean.
You can only do what you can do.
Yes, exactly. And what I'm doing here in Hawaii is the same. I can do so little. Some people say it's meaningless because I have them for 1 month and they have to go back to Fukushima. And some people say, what you're doing is meaningless. And I get that comment sometimes. And I just say, maybe that's what you think. And I'm doing what I can. I'm doing something I can do. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this year, 2017 summer, I'll be hosting 100th person from Fukushima to Hawaii. So it's a big benchmark for me. Last year was count 96. So if we host more than 4 people, it's going to be more than 100.
You have sponsored 100 children.
We'll be sponsoring. Yeah, there are so many people. I shouldn't say I started, but there are so many people helping me. So it's wonderful.
What do you do on a day-to-day basis? Fundraisers or concerts? Or tell us a little about that.
Well, all year round, we do many fundraisers because fundraising is a crucial part. Unless I have money, I cannot invite them here because they have to fly. Flight is very expensive in the summertime between Tokyo and Kona, Hawaii. So just about a week ago, on March 11th, the 6th anniversary of Fukushima, and we did an event. I want to show you this. Can you see me?
Yes. It's a poster, and it says, Prayer for Fukushima, 6th anniversary of 3/11, Hawaiian Queen Coffee Garden, Saturday, March 11th. And who is your keynote person?
This one is Shizuno. She's a contemporary dancer from New York, originally. She's a quite amazing dancer. In her presence, you really feel her prayer and an amazing peace and love or compassion. You could say all of that.
So her prayer is movement. Yeah.
So this dancer danced to the music Ave Maria, Caccini Ave Maria, by soprano singer Kaori Lani Trainer, who's a Hawaiian opera singer. And I saw the audience all in tears. Very kind of sad note, but it's very appropriate for this prayer.
Mm-hmm.
There are quite a few people who passed, or we couldn't find the body yet. They're gone. They're gone from the family forever without leaving anything. It's quite a devastating day for many. We're still in prayer and mourning many people. and I'm doing the part I can to, you know, bring the kids here for learning and healing. As you know, again, and I teach medicine. We practice Japanese medicine using food as medicine. Food is medicine, actually. I don't have any other medicine. I have food as medicine. And we practice that when kids are here. And we teach them how to eat healthy so that they can be healthy for a long life, for a long time. That's what we do.
And you help them connect with nature.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't play outside when they're in Japan, can they?
Yeah, they can't. They can't. So they go to ocean. They are so happy. We let them swim with dolphins. They're so happy. Their kids side come back alive, and they're so happy. So I just look at their face in a smile and a splash, and I'm done. You know, I'm gonna do this for the rest of my life.
and I look at your face when you tell me about it, and I see your great big smile, and your eyes are sparkling, and your cheeks are all bunched up from your smile. And I know that this has great meaning.
Oh yeah.
There's no way that this could possibly be meaningless. This is another event on March 12th, concert fundraiser.
And the town. I live in Kona, Big Island, and Big Island is really big, a little bit smaller than Shikoku Island, one of the four major islands of Japan. Big Island is almost as big as Shikoku. Anyway, this group, do you see the women?
Yeah.
The women's choir, they're beautiful. They were so fun and funny. They dance, they kind of gig and sing a cappella. Their harmony on tap. And these four solo singers, they sang opera songs, and I play flute.
So you played the flute, and they sang?
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so this event was in another town, the east side of Hawaii.
And does Gen get to play for any of these fundraisers?
He does sometimes, but he's in Japan right now. He is visiting and teaching Rita Marie Johnson's The Connection Practice, a certified trainer now. This time I couldn't leave because of those two events I'm organizing. this time he's in Japan. Usually it's me go to Japan and teach.
I see that you have a Rasur Foundation started in Japan for your connection practice work.
Yes, we are starting Rasur Japan. Yeah, yeah. We created a corporation, non-profit corporation. Yeah.
And how is that going to integrate with your Fukushima Kids work?
I teach the children the connection practice. You know, if you have the skill of connection, your life-changing skill, actually, like NBC, like non-binary communication, is a life-changing skill that you always have your heart in your center. When you're making any decision, you can ask your heart, what do I need to know? The heart will give you answer and guidance. Always. You don't have to go to school, ask teacher, or meet a guru or religious leaders to get your answer. It's right in your heart. A connection practice, because you ask specific questions to your heart and search for answers from your heart after you are in coherence, means your brain and heart working together.
Yes.
You get an amazing answer. All the kids we are at the Fukushima Kids who had experience with me, they have amazing answer. And I'm sure they're going to face challenges in life, and not just the Fukushima Kids, but anyone will face challenge in your life, but you always have a guidance from your heart and you have a specific way to get there. That's an amazing gift. And that's what I'm teaching to the children, including Fukushima Kids, but anybody. And our aim right now is training enough teachers who can teach this in Japan.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org, that's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in Peace and Nonviolence in Action.
Okay, I want to integrate something with the Japanese culture here. I watched a panel discussion, you posted it in fact. It was a panel discussion with three people on the fifth anniversary of Fukushima. They were talking about the disaster was a disaster made in Japan. And they were blaming the magnitude of the disaster, the cover-ups, the collusion, all of that, on aspects of Japanese culture that have to do with obedience to authority, for example. And they were saying that the Japanese people don't have the option to change jobs, for example, that they're on one narrow track for their entire career. And they're very strongly trained to protect the interest of the company over personal interests or human interests. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit about Japanese culture and the magnitude of the Fukushima disaster.
I am a Japanese and I'm not one of those people who are in that. But it's true. What you said is we tend to go along with the authority. We have saying, Yoraba Taiju no Kage. You want to be under the big tree. That makes sense for survival, I guess. We don't go against corporation or government or authority. The company is like a family. They are above your own family sometimes. To be faithful and loyal to the company is so important because you work for the company for all your life. And I see that is changing. So there's a change in Japan too. I don't think young people are same as us, older ones. But we have been in that culture for a long time, since the beginning of the country, like 2,000 years of that. We follow the orders. And Japan is the country of order, beauty, or harmony. Harmony is very important, and harmony is great. But sometimes when you choose a different path, it's kind of creating disharmony. Like I'm often criticized creating disharmony because I do different things. And I speak out and I criticize my government or TEPCO or whatever publicly. I create disharmony, and maybe so. I'm called rebellious, and I don't fit in Japanese culture much because I cannot stay silent when I see something. I speak up and I stand up and say things that people don't want to hear. Anyway, that's me, and Japan is opposite of that. They choose more harmony and order, obedience, patience. There are lots of beauty in that. And some of it I want to be that way. But when it comes to the life or health of children, I can't be silent. Nobody can stop me. So that was part of the culture. The people who knew from the beginning it's already melted and they kept silent.
You have some anger you're dealing with about that too, right?
I have less. I'm learning, like I'm trying to understand where they're coming from, you know, after these 6 years. But I'm still, my need for like honesty and safety of the lives of children, that was so at stake when you didn't speak out about the truth of nuclear power plant accidents.
So you're trying to bring your empathy skills to bear to overcome your enemy images about the people who engaged in covering up the enormity of the disaster.
I'm working on it.
It's not a job that's ever finished, Yumi. That's been my experience, is that it's work that needs to be done over and over and over again. There'll be something that comes up that'll trigger you all over again.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I have enemy image work and blame-free state by Francois Bosley, another NBC teacher.
Yeah, I know Francois.
So Francois's teaching is so succinct, and I'm loving it.
Mm-hmm.
His teaching has become so sharp-pointed, and it works so beautifully.
For me, it's about the rest of the natural world. And for me, it gets triggered all over again when they have a mass die-off, or when I read news about the coral bleaching. These are the things that shake me to the core.
You know, according to Helen Caldicott, we're dealing with people who don't know squat. Between radiation and global cremation, the world will become two kinds of hot. Hee-haw!
Okay, so tell me about Helen Caldicott.
Yeah, we traveled around the world trying to shut down the nuclear power plants before Y2K.
Really?
We created a campaign called World Atomic Safety Holiday Wash Campaign.
World Atomic Safety Holiday.
They have to have a holiday to be safe between the year 1999 to year 2000. There may be computer glitches, and some of the nuclear power plants in the world are run by computers. Just wanted that time to be shut down. It wasn't a big thing. It's big because of loss of money by shutting it down. It's huge for the corporation, but for the safety of the planet, we went all around the world who has nuclear power plants, the government to government, to ask for the shutdown. So Helen and I were together in that at that time. We even went to Berlin for the G8 conference, and we went inside the conference pretending we were journalists with the cameras. Actually, we went in to the conference, and we were able to speak to all the delegates of the world.
Were any of them receptive? Did anybody go ahead and shut down their nuclear plants just temporarily while the computers were getting reprogrammed?
Yes. European unions, all the EU countries, they shut down.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I don't say it's because of us, but yeah, we did something. And none in US, none in Japan. Yeah. That was the biggest two countries other than France. United States had 104 nuclear power plants. Japan has 54 nuclear power plants, and France has 58. So those three are gigantic nuclear states.
I'm just doing some addition in my head. That's more than half of the nuclear power plants on the planet, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Just with those three countries.
France and Japan are three major countries.
France, Japan, and the United States are the big ones. United States is biggest. France and Japan together are about the same size as the United States.
Exactly.
And those three together account for half of the nuclear power plants on the planet.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Where are the others?
There's quite a few in England and in Germany. After March 11, they shut it down. And there are some in Korea. There's some in China. China and India is going to build more. That is a bit scary. Of course, Russia and Ukraine and all those former Soviet Union countries have nuclear power as well.
So did Russia shut down for the Y2K?
I don't know. We didn't go there.
So talk to me about India.
They and also China. to aggressive pro-nuclear policies. And I think those countries is not doing this for energy. They are doing so for getting plutonium.
For weapons. For weapons.
I think all the countries, even Japan, the real agenda is to be capable of creating nuclear weapons.
Yes.
Nuclear potential or nuclear weapon potential, they call it. To be strong voice in the world, you have to be strong. Strong means have capability to kill many people. That sounds odd to me, but that's the truth.
Yeah, it's beyond odd. It's tragic.
Mm. Anyway, so my country is not exception. We have one of the biggest depository of plutonium in Lokashomura, northern part of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't speak about India and China, but I know they want more nuclear power plants.
What, the part that really bums me, that just boggles my mind, is how it is that no one is talking about reducing demand. We don't need that much energy. Nobody is talking about controlling population growth so that we need less everything, less energy, less food, less transportation and shipping, less everything.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Japan will be a good country for that. So our population is rapidly reducing. Do you know that?
No.
In decline, yes.
Are there people deciding not to have children?
No, it's not because we decided not to. We can't have children. I'm suspecting radiation has something to do with it. Because when you are exposed constantly, even low-level radiation, the miscarriage rate goes up. You can't have a healthy baby when you're exposed to radiation all the time.
You know, statistical methodology distracts us from our biology. Since radiation can cause degradation, think cell pathophysiology. Radiation packs lots of clout. Your cells are not nearly that stout. The damage it brings is one of those things your body does better without. Hee-haw!
Are you imagining that this goes all the way back to Hiroshima?
I cannot say that because after Hiroshima, we had so many babies born and our population grows. We have a huge decline of population.
Just since Fukushima. What about the life expectancy? Are people dying younger?
As you know, Japan had the longest longevity in the world for many years.
Yes.
But now I don't think we're the number one. Every year we were living longer, but we are not expanding our longevity anymore. So there may be a phase of decline as well. Our longevity is not prolonged.
Like it used to be, and the birth rate has gone way down.
Gone down. So I think we are in a population reduction phase. We're going to be losing population very quickly, very quickly.
I do want to wrap up pretty soon, though. I don't want to keep you from your host family.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you to let us know how we can help.
Okay. One thing you can do is to share our website to know what we're doing, to let your friends know what we're doing, FukushimaKidsHawaii.com.
Okay.
It's even in English, it's not in Japanese. I am doing this in English typically because this is a global issue. It's not just about Fukushima. This is my opinion only, okay? Everybody on the planet going to be affected by this. Bigger or smaller, I don't know, but more or less, everyone is going to be affected by the consequences of the Fukushima tragedy.
Well, you know, another thing I picked up from that panel discussion, it's not over. It seems bizarre to be celebrating the 6th anniversary of something that's still happening.
It's not over.
From what I could understand, they diverted a river to build that plant, and the earthquake restored the river so that the river is now flowing right under where the thing is leaking. And so all the radiation is going out into the ocean, and they're getting measurable amounts now off the coast of Oregon. It's not over.
No.
And you're right, it is a global issue. So you're doing the website in English so that everybody can participate and try to give these children some respite from this overexposure that they're subjected to through no fault of their own, just because of where they live.
Mm-hmm. So that's one thing I can ask. And if you are willing, you can donate, make a donation. That would be helpful.
Is there a button on your website where people can click?
No, you can send a personal check. We are doing old way.
Ah, the old-fashioned way. Postal mail.
Yeah, write a note. Because I love receiving those letters and people send good wishes. That really keeps us going. I get it from around the world.
You can negotiate the currency exchange?
No, it has to be U.S. dollars.
Has to be U.S. dollars.
So it has to be to Fukushima Kids Hawaii.
Good, good. So that's how we can donate, and that's your website. And what about fundraiser events? What have you got coming up in the near future?
I'm having a Zumba party. Do you know Zumba?
No.
Zumba is something I learned in Hawaii. It's not Hawaiian, but it's a Latin fitness dance.
Ah.
I have lots of fun doing that, and I have great teachers that I learned this fitness dance. But they have often party and they do fundraisers for like breast cancer fundraising for the homeless or street children or women's shelters. And I'll be doing Zumba fundraiser.
Okay.
Yeah, that's coming in, I think, beginning of May.
Oh, okay.
And in Hiroshima Day, August 6th, we're going to be having Broadway musical songs. It's another talented singer from Kona. Is singing popular Broadway songs to Fukushima children. The kids are going to be here on that day. So that's going to be August 6th.
Oh, beautiful.
And then I'm going to have another event on November, maybe 11th. And that's a violin concert.
Uh-huh.
And almost every month I do a fundraiser at my house, garage sale. I like people to think about recycling more, you know, to reusing, recycling. And so I do the garage sale, whatever unwanted things you can donate to me.
And the proceeds go to Fukushima Kids. All right. Yeah. I like that. That's real grassroots fundraising there.
It doesn't create much money. Each time I get, if I get $100, that's great.
Okay. And just to put it in perspective for the listeners, how much does a plane ticket cost?
Okay. Typically during the summertime, the high season, it could be as high as $2,000.
Oh.
And I try to book early. I sometimes get a special deal about $1,400 a person. And then I have to have somebody who takes the children from Fukushima to here, the adults. Kids can't just travel alone. We pay for that.
Uh-huh.
They're going to stay here for 1 month. So we rent a house. Two houses usually, because we have 16 people. So we rent like a vacation rental, and then we feed them. That food as medicine is the most valuable part of this program. We don't just give them sweets and pizza and chocolates and donuts. We don't do that. They need to eat healthy. They get like vegetables. You know, when they come, they don't like it. But by the time 1 month later, they crave for vegetables. They crave for my salad. I want to eat yumi salad. So it's fun to see the change. They drink green smoothie every day. So it's organic, local. And that costs money too. Anyway, if we have like $30,000 a year to run this program, we are good.
Mm-hmm.
And this year we have raised over $7,000. So that's good.
Do you ever do anything with the online fundraising platforms like GoFundMe or Kickstarter?
Actually, there's one going right now, GoFundMe. So I've raised $1,770.
Well, you can send me that link too. I'd be happy to make that link public as well. I want to see this available to as many children as possible.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the parents will pay the rest, you know. When I don't come up with the money, the parents has been paying their airfare. Each year I want $30,000, but I never able to reach that goal. So the children's parents, they are willing to put some money for their kids.
Is there anything else that you would like the listeners to know before we say thank you very much and go our separate ways?
We've come a long way from 2010, don't we?
That's for sure.
So anyway, here is Fukushima Kids Hawaii address and website. And GoFundMe platform is also in your chat.
Good.
So you can share that later with your friends.
I will share that widely.
I really am grateful to Miki Kashtan, everybody who taught me nonviolent communication, Francois, and I'm so grateful. Yeah, Marshall Rosenberg. And also Rita Marie Johnson, who taught me connection practice. Without those practices, I don't think I was able to continue. It was too much pain, too much anger, too much whatever. I would gone crazy.
Yeah.
These practices kept me sane and stay connected to my heart, what I want to do, what a difference I want to make. And I was able to connect with my mission. One last thing, if you are thinking about connecting to your heart, get the connection practice downloaded in you.
Yeah.
And now it's available in Japan. That is my joy. Finally, it took me many years to be able to form this in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I had so many mess in my life. I have my own clutters in me. That is, lots of anger, and that need to be cleared before I was able to do this.
And it's just wonderful that you and Gen are in it together. I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And I imagine you get a lot of mutual support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are supportive of each other. I'm so blessed to have him in my life.
Yeah. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today. And with that, as you can hear, the Skype connection went absolutely foul. So here's the information I promised. Tax-deductible donations to Fukushima Kids Hawaii can be made through Fukushima Kids Hawaii's GoFundMe site. That's gofundme.com/Fukushima Kids Hawaii with Hawaii abbreviated HI, with no spaces and no punctuation. Better still, you can send a personal check in U.S. dollars, please, payable to Fukushima Kids Hawaii, and a personal note to Yumi and Gen at Fukushima Kids Hawaii, 75-286 Honi Street, Kailua, Kona, Hawaii, 96740. And I'll spell those proper names. Honi Street is H-O-E-N-E. Kailua is K-A-I-L-U-A. And Kona is K-O-N-A. Once again, that address is Fukushima Kids Hawaii, 75-286 Honi Street, Kailua, Kona, Hawaii, 96740. Be sure to mention that you heard Yumi's interview on Sequitur, Unnatural Disaster. Once again, the website is FukushimaKidsHawaii.com. That's all one word and no punctuation, with Hawaii spelled out. H-A-W-A-I-I. So I'll close with a final arigato gozaimashita to Yumi and Gen for carrying a very important torch, to Latvian mezzo-soprano Elena Garanta for a beautiful performance of Caccini's Ave Maria, to Harmony on Tap, a.k.a. Hot, for a stirring performance of Here Comes the Sun by George Harrison from the Beatles' Abbey Road album, to Deba Kale Earnshaw for her moving poetry reading, to Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.